This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to The Atlantic, the historic magazine that offers a unique editorial view on the arts, politics, and current events. Catch up on the important news happening in the world around you. The Atlantic, found only here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is The Atlantic, and I'm your reader, Susan, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will begin reading from the August 2025 copyright issue of The Atlantic. Our first article is Tossing and Turning Through Our National Sleep Crisis by Jennifer Sloan. American Insomnia. I like to tell people that the night before I stopped sleeping, I slept. Not only that, I slept well. Years ago, a boyfriend of mine, even keeled during the day but restless at night, told me how hard it was to toss and turn while I instantly sank into the crude Neanderthal slumber of the dead. When I found a magazine job that allowed me to keep night owl hours, my rhythms had the precision of an automatic clock. I fell asleep at 1 a.m. I woke up at 9. 1 to 9, 1 to 9, 1 to 9, night after night, day after day. As most researchers tell you, this click track is essential to health outcomes. One needs consistent bedtimes and wake-up times. And I had them, naturally. When I lost my alarm clock, I didn't bother getting another until I had an early morning flight to catch. Then, one night, maybe 2 months before I turned 29, that vagueing sense that normal sleepers have when they're lying in bed, their thoughts pixelating into surreal images, their mind listing towards unconsciousness, completely deserted me. How bizarre, I thought. I fell asleep at 5 a.m. This started to happen pretty frequently. I had no clue why. The circumstances of my life, both personally and professionally, were no different from the week, month, or 2 months before. And my life was good. Yet I'd somehow transformed into an appliance without an off switch. I saw an acupuncturist. I took Tylenol PM. I sampled a variety of supplements, including melatonin, not really appropriate, I'd later learn, especially in the megawatt doses Americans take. Its real value is in resetting your circadian clock, not as a sedative. I ran 4 miles every day, did breathing exercises, listened to a meditation tape a friend gave me. Useless. I finally caved and saw my general practitioner, who prescribed Ambien, telling me to feel no shame if I needed it every now and then. But I did feel shame, lots of shame, and I'd always been phobic about drugs, including recreational ones. And now, a sedative? 2 words for you, Judy Garland. It was only when I started enduring semi-regular involuntary all-nighters, which I knew were all-nighters because I got out of bed and sat upright through them trying to read or watch TV, that I capitulated. I couldn't continue to stumble brokenly through the world after nights of virtually no sleep. I hated Ambien. One of the dangers with this strange drug is that you may do freaky things at 4 a.m. without remembering, like making a stack of peanut butter sandwiches and eating them. That didn't happen to me, I don't think. But the drug made me squirrely and tearful. I stopped taking it. My sleep went back to its usual syncopated disaster. In Sleepless, a memoir of insomnia, Marie Dariusz lists the thinkers and artists who have pondered the brutality of sleeplessness in their distinguished company. Duras, Gide, Pavese, Sontag, Plarth, Dostoevsky, Murakami, Borgia, Kafka, especially Kafka, whom she calls literature's patron saint of insomniacs. Dread of night, he wrote, dread of not night, not to mention F. Scott Fitzgerald, whose sleeplessness was triggered by a single night of warfare with a mosquito. But there was sadly no way to interpret my sleeplessness as a nocturnal manifestation of tortured genius or artistic brilliance. It felt as though I'd been poisoned. It was that arbitrary, that abrupt. When my insomnia started, the experience wasn't just context-free. It was content-free. People would ask what I was thinking while lying awake at 4 a.m., and my answer was nothing. My mind whistled like a conch shell. But over time, I did start thinking, or worrying, I should say, and then perseverating, and then outright panicking. At first, songs would whip through my head, and I couldn't get the orchestra to pack up and go home. Then I started to fear the evening, going to bed too early in order to give myself extra runway to zonk out. This, I now know, is a typical amateur's move and a horrible idea, because the bed transforms from a zone of security into a zone of torment. And anyway, that's not how the circadian clock works. Now, I would have conscious thoughts when I couldn't fall asleep, which can basically be summarized as insomnia math. Why am I not falling asleep? Dear God, let me fall asleep. Oh, my God, I only have 4 hours left to fall asleep. Oh, my God, now I only have 3 hours. My God, now two. Oh, my God, now just one. The insomniac is not so much in dialogue with sleep, Dariusz writes, as with the apocalypse. I would shortly discover that this cycle was textbook insomnia perdition. A fear of sleep loss in itself causes sleep loss that in turn generates an even greater fear of sleep loss that in turn generates even more sleep loss, until the next thing you know, you're in an insomnia galaxy spiral with a dark behavioral and psychological and sometimes neurobiological life of its own. I couldn't recapture my nights. Something that once came so naturally now seemed as impossible as flying. How on earth could this have happened? To this day, whenever I think about it, I still can't believe it did. In light of my tortured history with the subject, you can perhaps see why I generally loathe stories about sleep. What they're usually about is the dangers of sleep loss, not sleep itself. And as a now inveterate insomniac, I've already got a multi-volume fright compendium in my head of all the terrible things that can happen when sleep eludes you or you elude it. You will die of a heart attack or a stroke. You will become cognitively compromised and possibly dement. Your weight will climb. Your mood will collapse. The ramparts of your immune system will crumble. If you rely on medication for relief, you're doing your disorder all wrong. You're getting the wrong kind of sleep, an unnatural sleep. An addiction surely awaits. Heaven help you and that horse of Xanax you rode in on. It should go without saying that for some of us, knowledge is not power. It's just more kindling. The cultural discussions around sleep would be a lot easier if the tone weren't quite so hectoring or so smug. A case in point. In 2019, the neuroscientist Matthew Walker, the author of Why We Sleep, gave a TED Talk that began with a cheerful disquisition about testicles. They are, apparently, significantly smaller in men who sleep 5 hours a night rather than seven or more, and that two-hour difference means lower testosterone levels, too, equivalent to those of someone 10 years their senior. The consequences of short sleep for women's reproductive systems are similarly dire. This, Walker says, just 54 seconds in, is the best news that I have for you today. He makes good on his promise. What follows is the old medley of familiars with added verses about inflammation, suicide, cancer. Walker's sole recommendation at the end of his sermon is the catechism that so many insomniacs, or casual media consumers for that matter, can recite. Sleep in a cool room, keep your bedtimes and wake-up times regular, avoid alcohol and caffeine. Also, don't nap. I will now say about Walker, 1. His book is in many ways quite wonderful, erudite and wide-ranging, and written with a flaring energy when it isn't excessively pleased with itself. 2. Both Why We Sleep and Walker's TED Talk focus on sleep deprivation, not insomnia, with the implicit and sometimes explicit assumption that too many people choose to blow off sleep in favor of work or life's various seductions. If public awareness is Walker's goal, certainly a virtuous one, he and his fellow researchers have done a very good job in recent years with the enthusiastic assistance of my media colleagues, who clearly find stories about the hazards of sleep deprivation irresistible. In the wine-dark sea of internet contact, they're click sirens. Walker's TED Talk has been viewed nearly 24 million times. For years, we were fighting against I'll Sleep When I'm Dead. Eric Prather, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Research Program at UC San Francisco, told me. Now, the messaging that sleep is a fundamental pillar of human health has really sunk in. Yet greater awareness of sleep deprivation's consequences hasn't translated into a better rested populace. Data from the CDC showed that the proportion of Americans reporting insufficient sleep held constant from 2013 through 2022 at roughly 35%. From 2020 to 2022, as anxiety about the pandemic eased, the percentage actually climbed. So here's the first question I have. In 2025, exactly how much of our sleep opportunity, as the experts call it, is under our control? According to the most recent government data, 16.4% of American employees work non-standard hours. Their health suffers in every category. The World Health Organization now describes night shift work as probably carcinogenic. Adolescents live in a perpetual smog of sleep deprivation because they're forced to rise far too early for school. Researchers call their plight social jet lag. Young mothers and fathers live in a smog of sleep deprivation because they're forced to rise far too early or erratically for their kids. Adults caring for aging parents lose sleep too. The chronically ill frequently can't sleep. Same with some who suffer from mental illness, and many veterans and many active duty military members and menopausal women and perimenopausal women and the elderly, the precariat, the poor. Sleep opportunity is not evenly distributed across the population, Prather noted, and he suspects that this contributes to health disparities by class. In 2020, the National Center for Health Statistics found that the poorer Americans were, the greater their likelihood of reporting difficulty falling asleep. If you look at the CDC map of the United States' most sleep-deprived communities, you'll see that they loop straight through the Southeast and Appalachia. Black and Hispanic Americans also consistently report sleeping less, especially Black women. Even for people who aren't contending with certain immutables, the cadence of modern life have proved inimical to sleep. Widespread electrification laid waste to our circadian rhythms 100 years ago, when they lost any basic correspondence with the sun. Now, compounding matters, we're contending with the currents of a wired world. For white-collar professionals, it's hard to imagine a job without the woodpecker incursions of email or weekend and late-night work. Most of us can certainly do more to improve or reclaim our sleep, but behavioral change is difficult, as anyone who's vowed to lose weight can attest. And when the conversation around sleep shifts its onus to the individual, which, let's face it, is the American way, we shift the burden of child care to the individual, we shift the burden of health care to the individual, we sidestep the fact that the public and private sectors alike are barely doing a thing to address what is essentially a national health emergency. Given that we've decided that an adequate night's sleep is a matter of individual will, I now have a second question. How are we to discuss those who are suffering not just from inadequate sleep, but from something far more severe? Are we to lecture them in the same menacing, moralizing way? If the burden of getting enough sleep is on us, should we consider chronic insomniacs, for whom sleep is a nightly gladiatorial struggle, the biggest failures in the armies of the underslept? Those who can't sleep suffer a great deal more than those gifted with sleep will ever know. Yet insomniacs frequently feel shame about the solutions they've sought for relief, namely medication, likely because they can detect a subtle judgmental undertone about this decision, even from their loved ones. Resorting to drugs means they are lazy, refusing to do simple things that might ease their passage into unconsciousness. It means they are neurotic, requiring pills to transport them into a natural state that every other animal on earth finds without aid. Might I suggest that these views are unenlightened? In some respects, chronic insomnia is similar to where depression was in the past. We'd say, major depression, and people would say, everybody gets down now and then. John Winkleman, a psychiatrist in the sleep medicine division at Harvard Medical School, said at a panel I attended last summer, Dariuszka, the author of Sleepless, puts it more bluntly. I didn't sleep all night, sleepers say to insomniacs who feel like replying that they haven't slept all their life. The fact is, at least 12% of the U.S. population suffers from insomnia as an obdurate condition. Among millennials, the number pops up to 15%, and 30 to 35% of Americans suffer from some of insomnia's various symptoms: trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, or waking too early, at least temporarily. In 2024, there were more than 2,500 sleep disorder centers in the U.S., accredited by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Prather told me the wait time to get into his sleep clinic at UCSF is currently a year. That's better than it used to be, he added. Until a few months ago, our wait list was closed. We couldn't fathom giving someone a date. So what I'm hoping to do here is not write yet another reproachful story about sleep, plump with misunderstandings and myths. Fixing sleep, obtaining sleep, is a tricky business. The work it involves and painful choices it entails deserve nuanced examination. Contrary to what you might have read, our dreams are seldom in black and white. Whenever I interviewed a clinician, psychiatrist, neuroscientist, or any other kind of expert for this story, I almost always open with the same question. What dogma about sleep do you think most deserves to be questioned? The most frequent answer by a long chalk is that we need 8 hours of it. A fair number of studies, it turns out, show that mortality rates are lowest if a person gets roughly 7 hours. Daniel F. Kripke, a psychiatrist at UC San Diego, published the most famous of these analyses in 2002. Parsing a sample of 1.1 million individuals and concluding that those who reported more than 8 hours of sleep a night experienced significantly increased mortality rates. According to Kripke's work, the optimal sleep range was a mere 6.5 to 7.4 hours. These numbers shouldn't be taken as gospel. The relationship between sleep duration and health outcomes is a devil's knot, though Kripke did his best to control for the usual confounds, age, sex, body mass index. But he could not control for the factors he did not know. Perhaps many of the individuals who slept 8 hours or more were doing so because they had an undetected illness, or an illness of greater severity than they'd realized, or other conditions Kripke hadn't accounted for. The study was also observational, not randomized. But even if they don't buy Kripke's data, sleep experts don't necessarily believe that 8 hours of sleep has some kind of mystical significance. Methodologically speaking, it's hard to determine how much sleep on average best suits us. And let's not forget the obvious. Sleep needs and abilities vary over the course of a lifetime and from individual to individual. There's even an extremely rare species of people known as natural short sleepers, associated with a handful of genes, who require only 4 to 6 hours a night. They tear through the world as if fired from a cannon. Yet 8 hours of sleep or else remains one of our culture's most stubborn shibboleths and an utter tyranny for many adults, particularly older ones. We have people coming into our insomnia clinic saying, I'm not sleeping 8 hours, when they're 70 years of age, Michael R. Irwin, a psychoneurologist at UCLA, told me, and the average sleep in that population is less than 7 hours. They attribute all kinds of things to an absence of sleep: decrements in cognitive performance and vitality, higher levels of fatigue, when often that's not the case. I mean, people get older and the drive to sleep decreases as people age. Another declaration I was delighted to hear: the tips one commonly reads to get better sleep are as insipid as they sound. Make sure that your bedroom is cool and comfortable, your bed is soft, you have a new mattress and a nice pillow. It's unusual that those things are really the culprit. Eric Knopfzinger, the former director of the Sleep Neuroimaging Program at the University of Pittsburgh's Medical School, told me. Most people self-regulate anyway. If they're cold, they put on an extra blanket. If they're too warm, they throw off the blanket. Truthfully, There's not a lot of data supporting those tips. Suzanne Burdich, a behavioral sleep medicine expert at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, told me. That includes the prescription on naps, she added, quite commonly issued in her world. In general, the research on naps suggests that short ones have beneficial outcomes and long ones have negative outcomes. But as always, cause and effect are difficult to disentangle. An underlying health condition could be driving those long naps. Many of us night owls have heard that the weather forecast for our old age is, well, cloudy to be honest, with a late afternoon chance of keeling over. According to one large analysis, we have a 10% increase in all-cause mortality over morning larks. But Jean Duffy, a neuroscientist distinguished for her expertise in human circadian rhythms at Brigham and Women's, told me she suspected that this was mainly because most night owls, like most people, are obliged to rise early for their job. So, wait, I said. Was she implying that if night owls could contrive workarounds to suit their biological inclination to go to bed late, the news probably wouldn't be as grim? Yes, she replied. A subsequent study showed that the owl-lark mortality differential dwindled to nil when the authors controlled for lifestyle. Apparently, owls are more apt to smoke and to drink more. So if you're an owl who's repelled by Marlboros and Jameson, you're fine. Kelly Glazer Barron, the director of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the University of Utah, told me that she'd love it if patients stopped agonizing over the length of their individual sleep phases. I didn't get enough deep sleep, they fret, thrusting their Apple Watch at her. I didn't get enough REM. And yes, she said, insufficiencies in REM or slow-wave sleep can be a problem, especially if they reflect an underlying health issue. But clinics don't look solely at sleep architecture when evaluating their patients. I often will show them my own data, Barron said. It always shows I don't have that much deep sleep, which I find so weird because I'm a healthy, middle-aged woman. In 2017, after observing these anxieties for a year, Barron coined a term for sleep neuroticism brought about by wearables, orthosomnia. But most surprising, to me anyway, was what I heard about insomnia and the black dog. There are far more studies indicating that insomnia causes depression than depression causes insomnia, said Wilfred Pidgeon, the director of the Sleep and Neurology Research Laboratory at the University of Rochester, which is not to say, he added, that depression can't or doesn't cause insomnia. These forces, in the parlance of health professionals, tend to be bidirectional. But I can't tell you how vindicating I found the idea that perhaps my own insomnia came first. A couple of years into my struggles with sleeplessness, a brilliant psychopharmacologist told me that my new condition had to be an episode of depression in disguise. And part of me thought, sure, why not? A soundtrack of melancholy had been playing at a low hum inside my head from the time I was 10. The thing was, I became outrageously depressed only after my insomnia began. That's when that low hum started to blare at a higher volume. Until I stopped sleeping, I never suffered from any sadness so crippling that it prevented me from experiencing joy. It never impeded my ability to socialize or travel. It never once made me contemplate antidepressants, and it most certainly never got in the way of my sleeping. The precipitating factor in my own brutal insomnia was, and remains, an infuriating mystery. Sleep professionals, I have learned, drink a lot of coffee. That was the first thing I noticed when I attended Sleep 2024, the annual conference of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine in Houston. Wandering through it was a dizzying experience, a sprawling testament to the scale and skyscraping profits. Coffee, oceans of it spilling from silver urns. More than 150 exhibitors showed up, showing how the skyscraping profit margins of Big Sleep. Sheep swag abounded. Drug reps were everywhere, their aggression tautly disguised behind old android smiles. The meds they hawked called the usual names that looked like high-value Scrabble words. I've never understood this branding strategy, honestly. If you want your customers to believe they're falling into a gentle, natural sleep, you should probably think twice before calling your drug Quufavig. I walked through the cavernous hall in a daze. It was overwhelming, really. At some point, it occurred to me that the noisy, overbusy, fluorescent quality of this product spectacular reminded me of the last place on Earth a person with a sleep disorder should be, a casino. The room was practically sunless. I saw very few clocks. After I spent an afternoon there, my circadian rhythms were shot to hell. But the conference itself? Extraordinary, covering miles of ground. I went to one symposium about sleep deserts, another about the genetics of sleep disturbance, and yet another about sleep and menopause. I walked into a colloquy about sleep and screens and had to take a seat on the floor because the room was bursting like a suitcase. Of most interest to me, though, were two panels, which I'll shortly discuss. One about how to treat patients with anxiety from new onset insomnia, and one on whether hypnotics are addictive. My final stop at the trade fair was the Alley of Beauty products, relevant, I presume, because they address the aesthetic toll of sleep deprivation. Within 5 minutes, an energetic young salesman made a beeline for me, clearly having noticed that I was a woman of a certain age. He gushed about a $2,500 infrared laser to goose collagen production and a $199 medical-grade peptide serum that ordinarily retails for $1,100. I told him I'd try the serum. Cheaper than Botox, and it does the same thing, he said approvingly, applying it to the crow's feet around my eyes. I stared in the mirror. Holy crap, the stuff was amazing. I'll take it, I told him. He was delighted. He handed me a box. The serum came in a gold syringe. You're a doctor, right? A beat. No, I finally said, a journalist. Can only a dermatologist? He told me it was fine. It's just that doctors were his main customers. The first line of treatment for chronic, irretractable sleeplessness, per the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. I've tried it, in earnest, at two different points in my life. It generally involves 6 to 8 sessions and includes, at minimum, identifying the patient's sleep-wake patterns through charts, diaries, wearables, stimulus control, setting consistent bedtimes and wake-up times, resisting the urge to stare at the clock, delinking the bed from anything other than sleep and sex, establishing good sleep habits, the stuff of every listicle, sleep restriction, compressing your sleep schedule, then slowly expanding it over time, and cognitive restructuring, or changing unhealthy thoughts about sleep. The cognitive restructuring component is the most psychologically paradoxical. It means taking every terrifying thing you've ever learned about the consequences of sleeplessness and pretending you've never heard of them. I pointed this out to Wilfred Pidgeon. For the medically anxious, it's tough, he agreed. We're trying to tell patients two things at the same time. You really need to get your sleep on track or you will have a heart attack 5 years earlier than you otherwise would. But also, stop worrying about your sleep so much because it's contributing to your not being able to sleep. And they're both true. Okay, I said, but if an insomniac crawls into your clinic after many years of not sleeping, he says people tend to wait about a decade, wouldn't they immediately see that these two messages live in tension with each other and dwell only on the heart attack? I tell the patient their past insomnia is water under the bridge, Pigeon says. We're trying to erase the added risk that ongoing chronic insomnia will have. Just because a person has smoked for 20 years doesn't mean they should keep smoking. He's absolutely right, but I'm not entirely convinced that these incentives make the cognitive dissonance of CBTI go away. When Sarah Nowakowski, a CBTI specialist at Baylor College of Medicine, gave her presentation at Sleep 2024's panel on anxiety and new onset insomnia, she said that many of her patients start reciting the grim facts from their Fitbits and talking about dementia. That's likely because they've read the studies. Rapid eye movement, REM, sleep, that vivid dream stage when our eyes race beneath our eyelids like mice under a blanket, is essential to emotional regulation and problem solving. Slow wave sleep, our deepest sleep, is essential for repairing our cells, shoring up our immune systems, and rinsing toxins from our brains, thanks to a watery complex of microcanals called the glymphatic system. We repair our muscles when we sleep. We restore our hearts. We consolidate memories and process knowledge, embedding important facts and disposing of trivial ones. We actually learn when we're asleep. Many insomniacs know all too well how non-negotiably vital sleep is and what the disastrous consequences are if you don't get it. I think of the daredevil experiment that Nathaniel Kleinman, the father of sleep research, informally conducted as a graduate student in 1922, enlisting five classmates to join him in seeing how long they could stay awake. He lasted the longest, a staggering 115 hours, but at a terrible price, temporarily going mad with exhaustion, arguing on the fifth day with an imaginary foe about the need for organized labor. And I think of Alan Richthofen, another pioneer in the field, who in 1989 had the fiendish idea to place rats on a spinning mechanism that forced them to stay awake if they didn't want to drown. They eventually dropped dead. So, these are the kinds of facts a person doing CBTI has to ignore. Still, whenever a patient's terrors concern the present or the future, it is the job of any good CBTI practitioner to help fact-check or right-size them through Socratic questioning. But the main anchor of CBT1 is sleep restriction therapy. I tried it back when I was 29, when I dragged my wasted self into a sleep clinic in New York. I've tried it once since. I couldn't stick with it either time. The concept is simple. You severely limit your time in bed, paring away every fretful, superfluous minute you'd otherwise be awake. If you discover from a week's worth of sleep diary entries or your wearable that you spend 8 hours buried in your duvet but sleep for only five of them, you consolidate those splintered hours into one block of five, setting the same wake-up time every day, going to bed a mere 5 hours before. Once you've averaged sleeping those 5 hours for a few days straight, you reward your body by going to bed 15 minutes earlier. If you achieve success for a few days more, you add another 15 minutes and then another until you're up to whatever the magic number is for you. No napping. The idea is to build up enough sleep pressure to force your body to collapse and surrender. Sleep restriction can be a wonderful method. But if you have severe insomnia, the idea of reducing your sleep time is petrifying. Technically, I suppose, you're not really reducing your sleep time, you're just consolidating it. But practically speaking, you are reducing your sleep, at least in the beginning, because dysregulated sleep isn't an accordion, obligingly contracting itself into a case. Contracting it takes time, or at least it did for me. The process was murder. If you get people to really work their way through it, and sometimes that takes holding people's hands, it ends up being more effective than a pill, Ronald Kessler, a renowned psychiatrist epidemiologist at Harvard, told me when I asked him about CBTI. The problem is the formidable size of that if. CBTI takes a lot more work than taking a pill, so a lot of people drop out. They do. One study I perused had an attrition rate of 40%. 26 years ago, I too joined the legions of the quitters. In hindsight, my error was my insistence on trying this grueling regime without Valium or Ativan or Xanax, though my doctor had recommended that I start one. But I was still afraid of drugs in those days, and I was still in denial that I'd become hostage to my own brain's terrorism. I was sure that I still had the power to negotiate. Competence had, until that moment, defined my whole life. I persuaded the doctor to let me try without drugs. As she'd predicted, I failed. The graphs in my sleep diary looked like volatile weeks on the stock exchange. For the first time ever, I did need an antidepressant. The doctor wrote me a prescription for Paxil and a bottle of Xanax to use until I got up to cruising altitude. All SSRIs take a while to kick in. I didn't try sleep restriction again until many years later. Paxil sufficed during that time. It made me almost stupid with drowsiness. I was sleepy at night and vague during the day. I needed Xanax for only a couple of weeks, which was just as well because I didn't much care for it. The doctor had prescribed too powerful a dose, though it was the smallest one. I was such a rookie with drugs in those days that it never occurred to me I could just snap the pill in half. Have I oversimplified the story of my insomnia? Probably. At the top of Sleep 2024's panel about anxiety and new-onset insomnia, Lisha Cudahy, a director at large for the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine, said something that made me wince, namely that her patients have a very vivid perception of pre-insomnia sleep being literally perfect. I've never had a bad night of sleep before now. Okay, guilty as charged. While it's true that I'd slept brilliantly, and I stand by this, brilliantly, in the 16 years before I first sought help, I was the last kid to fall asleep at slumber parties when I was little. Cudahy also said that many of her patients declare they're certain, implacably certain, that they are unfixable. They feel like something broke, she said, which is what I wrote just a few pages back. Poisoned, broke, same thing. By the time Cudahy finished speaking, I had to face an uncomfortable truth. I was a standard-issue sleep clinic zombie. But when patients say they feel like something broke inside their heads, they aren't necessarily wrong. An insomniac's brain does change in neurobiological ways. There is something in the neurons that change during sleep in patients with significant sleep disruptions, said Eric Nofsinger, who, while at the University of Pittsburgh, had one of the world's largest databases of brain imaging studies of sleeping human beings. If you're laying down a memory, then that circuitry is hardwired for that memory. So one can imagine that if your brain is doing this night after night, we know that the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, our body's first responder to stress, is overreactivated in the chronically underslept. If the insomniac suffers from depression, their REM phase tends to be longer and more dense. With the limbic system, the amygdala, the hippocampus, where our primal drives are housed, going wild, roaring its terrible roars and gnashing its terrible teeth. You can imagine how this would also make depressives some consciously less motivated to sleep. Who wants to face their Gorgon dreams? Insomniacs suffering from anxiety experience this problem too, though to a lesser degree. It's their deep sleep that's mainly affected, slimming down and shallowing out. And in all insomniacs, throughout the night, the arousal centers of the brain keep clattering away, as does the prefrontal cortex in charge of planning, decision-making, whereas in regular sleepers, these buzzing regions go offline. So when someone with insomnia wakes up the next morning and says, "I don't think I slept at all last night," in some respects that's true, Nofsinger told me, because the parts of the brain that should have been resting did not. And why didn't they rest? The insomniacs can't say. The insomniac feels at once responsible and helpless when it comes to their misery. I must be to blame, but I can't be to blame. The feeling that sleeplessness is happening to you, not something you're doing to yourself, sends you on a quest for non-psychological explanations. Lots of physiological conditions can cause sleep disturbances, can't they? Obstructive sleep apnea, for instance, which affects nearly 30 million Americans, many autoimmune diseases, too. At what point, I'll confess that I started asking the researchers I spoke with whether insomnia itself could be an autoimmune disorder, because that's what it felt like to me, as if my brain is going after itself with brickbats. I didn't tolerate my Paxil brain for long. I weaned myself on, returned to normal for a few months, and assumed that my sleeplessness had been a freak event, like one of those earthquakes in a city that never has them. But then my sleep started to slip away again, and by age 31, I couldn't recapture it without chemical assistance. Prozac worked for years on its own, but it blew out whatever circuit in my brain generates metaphors. When I turned to the antidepressants that kept the electricity flowing, I needed sleep medication too, proving to my mind that melancholy couldn't have been the mother of my sleep troubles, but the lasting result of them. I've used the lowest doses of Klonopin to complement my SSRIs for years. In times of acute stress, I need gabapentin or Unisom too. Unisom is fine. Gabapentin also turns my mind into an empty prairie. Edibles, which I've also tried, turn my brain to porridge the next day. Some evidence suggests that cannabis works as a sleep aid, but more research evidently is required. Sorry. Which brings me to the subject of drugs. I come neither to praise nor to bury them, but I do come to reframe the discussion around them, inspired by what a number of researcher clinicians said about hypnotics and addictions during the Sleep 2024 panel on the subject. They started with a simple question: how do you define addiction? It's true that many of the people who have taken sleep medications for months or years rely on them. Without them, the majority wouldn't sleep, at least in the beginning, and a good many would experience rebound insomnia if they didn't wean properly, which can be even worse. One could argue that this dependence is tantamount to addiction. But we don't say people are addicted to their hypertension medication or statins, though we know in certain instances lifestyle changes could obviate the need for either one. Yet we still think of sleep medications as drugs, a word that in this case carries a whiff of stigma, partly because mental illness still carries a stigma, but also because sleep medications legitimately do have the potential for recreational use and abuse. If you see a patient who's been taking medication for a long time, Tom Roth, the founder of the Sleep Disorders and Research Centers at Henry Ford Hospital, said during the panel, you have to think, are they drug-seeking or therapy-seeking? The overwhelming majority, he and other panelists noted, are taking their prescription drugs for relief, not kicks. They may depend on them, but they're not abusing them. Still, let's posit that many long-term users of sleep medication do become dependent. Now let's consider another phenomenon commonly associated with reliance on sleep meds. You enter Garland and Hendricks territory in a hurry. First you need one pill, then you need two. Eventually you need a fistful with a fifth of gin. Yet a 2024 cohort study, which involved nearly 1 million Danes who used benzodiazepines long-term, found that those who used them for 3 years or more, 67,398 people to be exact, only 7% exceeded their recommended dose. Not a trivial number, certainly, if you're staring across an entire population. But if you're evaluating the risk of taking a hypnotic as an individual, you'd be correct to assume that your odds of dose escalation are pretty low. Then there's a difference between abuse and dependence. That dependence doesn't mean a mad chase for more milligrams. That people depend on drugs for a variety of other naturally reversible conditions and don't suffer any stigma. Those nuances matter. The problem, he told me, is when the benefits stop outweighing those downsides. Let's say the medications lose efficacy over time. Right, that 7%, and over-the-counter sleep meds, whose active component is usually diphenhydramine, more commonly known as Benadryl, are potentially even more likely to lose their efficacy. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine advises against them. And let's say you did stop your medication. Your sleep could be worse than it was before you started it, at least for a while. People should know about that risk. A small but even more hazardous risk, a seizure for those who abruptly stop taking high doses of benzodiazepines after they've been on them for a long period of time. The likelihood is low. The exact percentage is almost impossible to ascertain. But any risk of seizure is worth knowing about. So should these things even be considered a part of an addiction, he asked? At what point does treatment become an addiction? I don't know. For years, medication has worked for me. I've stopped beating myself up about it. If the only side effects I'm experiencing from taking 0.5 milligrams of Klonopin is being dependent on 0.5 milligrams of Klonopin, is that really such a problem? There's been a lot of confusing noise about sleep medications over the years. Weak science, alarming FDA black box warnings, and media reportings have fueled an anti-benzodiazepine movement, said an editorial in the March 2024 issue of the American Journal of Society. This has created an atmosphere of fear and stigma among patients, many of whom can benefit from such medications. A case in point, for a long time, the public that believed that benzodiazepines dramatically increased the risk of Alzheimer's disease, thanks to a 2014 study in the British Medical Journal that got the usual five-alarm fire treatment by the media. Then 2 years later, another study came along, also in the British Medical Journal, saying, never mind, nothing to see here. That study may one day prove problematic too, but the point is, more work needs to be done. A different paper, again by Donald Kripke, the fellow who argued that 7 hours of sleep a night predicted the best health outcomes, may provide more reason for concern. In a study published in 2012, he looked at more than 10,000 people on a variety of sleep medications and found that they were several times more likely to die within 2.5 years than a matched cohort, even when controlling for a range of culprits: age, sex, alcohol use, smoking status. Those who took as few as 18 pills a year had a 3.6-fold increase. Those who took more than 132 had a 5.3-fold one. John Winkleman doesn't buy it. Really, he told me, what makes a lot more sense to me to ask, why did people take these medications in the first place? And for what it's worth, a 2023 study funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse and published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that people on stable, long-term doses of benzodiazepine who go off their medication have worse mortality rates in the following 12 months than those who stay on it. So maybe you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Still, I take Kripke's study seriously because, well, I don't know, emotional reasons, because other esteemed thinkers still think there's something to it. In my own case, the most compelling reasons to get off medications are the more mundane ones: the scratchy little cognitive impairments it can cause during the day, the risk of falls as you get older. I should correct myself here. Falling when you're older has the potential to be not mundane, but very bad. Medications can also cause problems with memory as one ages, even if they don't cause Alzheimer's in the garden variety brain termites of middle and old age are bummer enough. And maybe, most generally, why have a drug in your system if you can learn to live without it? My suspicion is that most people who rely on sleep drugs would prefer natural sleep. So yes, I'd love to say one day I'd make a third run at CBTI with the hopes of weaning off my medication, even if it means going through a hell spell of double exhaustion. Some part of me, the one that's made of pessimism, is convinced that it won't work no matter how long I stick with it. But Michael Irwin at UCLA told me something reassuring. His research suggested if you have trouble with insomnia or difficulty maintaining your sleep, mindfulness medication while lying in bed can be just as effective as climbing out of bed, sitting in a chair, and waiting until you're tired enough to crawl back in, a pillar of CBTI, and one that I absolutely despise. I do it sometimes because I know I should, but it's lonely and freezing, a form of banishment. And if CBTI doesn't work, Michael Gardner, the director of the Sleep and Health Research Program at the University of Arizona, laid out an alternative at Sleep 2024, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or ACT. The basic idea is exactly what the name suggests. You accept your lot, you change exactly nothing. This is one of those things I can't control. One could see how a mantra might help a person sleep, paradoxically. You then isolate what matters to you: being functional the next day, being a good parent, a good friend. Is your problem off the wall, Gardner asked, or is it your problem that you can't get beyond the wall, and is there another way? Because there is often another way. To be a good friend, to be a good parent, to be who and whatever it is you most value, you can live out a lot of those values without adequate sleep. When you look at some of these things, Gardner said, what you find is that the pain, or not sleeping, is actually only a small part of what is getting in the way of your life. It's really less about the pain itself and more about the suffering around the pain, and that's what we can fix. Even as I type, I'm skeptical of this method, too. My insomnia was so extreme at 29, and still can be to this day, that I'm not sure I'm tough enough or can summon enough of my inner Buddha, barely locatable on the best of days, to transcend its pain, at once towering and a bore. But if ACT doesn't work, and if CBTI doesn't work, and if mindfully meditating and acupuncture and neurofeedback and zillions of other things I've tried in the past don't work on their own, well, I'll go back on medication. Some people will judge me, I'm sure. What can I say? It's my life, not theirs. I'll wrap up by talking about an extraordinary man named Thomas Ware, once the chief of clinical psychobiology at the National Institute of Mental Health, now 83, still doing research. He was by far the most philosophical expert I spoke with, quick to find and maul the underlayer of whatever he was exploring. I really liked what he had to say about sleep. You've probably read the theory somewhere, it's a media chestnut, that human beings aren't necessarily meant to sleep in one long stretch, but rather in two shorter ones, with a dreamy middle-of-the-night entr'acte. In a famous 2001 paper, the historian A. Roger Eckert showed that the people in the pre-electrified British Isles used that interregnum to read, chat, poke the fire, pray, have sex. But it was Weir who nearly 10 years earlier found a biological basis for these rhythms of social life, discovering segmented sleep patterns in an experiment that exposed its participants to 14 hours of darkness each night. Their sleep split in two. Weir now knows firsthand what it is to sleep a divided sleep. I think what happens as you get older, he told me last summer, is that this natural pattern of human sleep starts intruding back into the world in which it's not welcome, the world we've created with artificial light. There's a melancholy quality to this observation, I know, but also a beauty. Consciously or not, Weir is reframing old age as a time of reintegration, not disintegration, a time when our natural bias for segmented sleep reasserts itself as our lives are winding down. His findings should actually be reassuring to everyone. People of all ages pop awake in the middle of the night and have trouble going back to sleep. One associates this phenomenon with anxiety if it happens in younger people, and no doubt that's frequently the cause. But it also rhymes with what may be a natural pattern. Perhaps we're meant to wake up. Perhaps broken sleep doesn't mean our sleep is broken, because another sleep awaits. And if we think of those middle-of-the-night awakenings as meant to be, Weir told me, perhaps we should use them differently, as some of our forebears did when they'd wake up in the night bathed in prolactin, a hormone that kept them relaxed and serene. They were kind of in an altered state, maybe a third state of consciousness you usually don't experience in modern life unless you're a meditator, and they would contemplate their dreams. Night awakenings, he went on to explain, tend to happen as we're exiting a REM cycle, when our dreams are most intense. We're not having an experience that a lot of our ancestors had of waking up and maybe processing or musing, or let's even say being informed by dreams. We should reclaim those moments at 3 or 4 a.m., was his view. Why not luxuriate in our dreams? If you know you're going to fall back asleep, he said, and if you just relax and maybe think about your dreams, that helps a lot. This assumes one has pleasant or emotional neural dreams, of course. But I take his point. He was possibly explaining, unwittingly, something about his own associative habits of mind, that maybe his daytime thinking is informed by the meandering stories he tells himself while he sleeps. The problem, unfortunately, is that the world isn't structured to accommodate a second sleep or a day informed by dreams. We live unnatural, anxious lives. Every morning we turn on our lights, switch on our computers, grab our phones, the whir begins. For now, this strange way of being is exclusively on us to adapt to. Sleep doesn't much curve to it, nor it to sleep. For those who struggle each night or day, praying for what should be their biologically given reprieve from the chaos, the world has proven an even harsher place. But there are ways to improve it. Through policy, by refraining from judgment of others, but also of ourselves. Meanwhile, I take comfort in the two hunter-gatherer tribes Weir told me about. One, he modestly noted, did not confirm his hypothesis of biphasic sleep. He couldn't remember their names, but I later looked them up. The San in Namibia and the Tsame in Bolivia. They average less than 6.5 hours of sleep a night, and neither has a word for insomnia. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Susan with The Atlantic. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.